good to be back to this week. We have our guests, Nirav Kanodra, Abhishek Paul, and Prasanna Vishwanathan here to take you through the news and events of the week. And this was a week of controversies. We had the Rana Ayoob money laundering probe. Then, of course, the Bharat Pay and Ashneel Grover saga continues. Also, there was this surreal story of the former NSE chief Chitra Ramakrishna being guided and led by a supposed yogi on things like financial projections, appointments, and whatnot, right? Aside from this, we had some other developments as well. There was the Quad meeting of foreign ministers. Travel norms have been relaxed. And of course, in the big sporting news, we had IPL auctions yesterday. So last week, we put out this really interesting episode on India's outreach to the Central Asian Republics. And I thought this was a very episode, covered many different facets. Rashmini Koparkar, who's an assistant professor at JNU, is very well-versed in this subject. And we spoke about the history of ties with these countries and also the geopolitical importance for India, and you know how Russia, America, China, everyone is kind of getting in on the action as well. So very, very comprehensive, very insightful episode. Do check it out for sure. Now, with that out of the way, let's talk about the money laundering probe. A money laundering probe tracked over 1.77 crores of bank deposits to journalist Rana Ayoob's account. According to a statement by the Enforcement Directorate, funds totaling 2.69 crores were raised on a crowdfunding platform Keto by the Washington Post journalist. These proceeds were then donated towards pediatrics department of Tilak Hospital in Delhi. However, these funds were also withdrawn in bank accounts of her sister and father. Ms. Ayoob has dismissed the claims of the ED, instead claiming that she provided those bank details as part of a request from Keto. Well, what do you guys make of this? Prasanna, we can start with you and the others can kind of chime in on this.
No, I think like we've been having a... This is not probably the first instance where allegations of irregularity have emerged as far as, you know, all this crowdfunded, you know, campaign goes. We had that Saket Gokhale, kind of a freelance RTI activist, and now he's full-time political operator as well. Similar kind of allegations emerge that he raised a lot of money and then used to fund his life. So, see, I guess what is happening is that a lot of these very suave, very clever operators, right, they've understood that there is a, you know, a huge financial monetary opportunity in tapping into the, you know, a very organized, vocal minority members of the minority committee, secular people, Congress leaning supporters who are in the SM, who kind of are willing to pay to hear these folks spew, you know, the most wild conspiracy theories, you know, revel in Hindu-phobic slurs, you know, basically dehumanize Hindus, you know, abuse the prime minister. So they've found that there is a huge market for it, actually. So basically, tapping into the market means that, you know, you need to, you know, indulge in a relentless, no-holds-barred behavior in social media. You need to reinforce the worst stereotypes about your opponent and all that. And they are willing to pay and donate for this emotional high, right? These clever operators are bound to exploit it, actually. And I think Ms. Ayoob, I guess, also has built up, has the religious victimization card to play. And I think she's also now well plugged into the global victimhood narrative complex. She's much more visible in terms of, like, I think Saket Gokhale, whatever said and done, he's like a very small-time player, right? Like, but Rana Ayoob is kind of plugged in into the global Islamist network. I mean, though that was a bad follow to Saudi's recently, but otherwise, I think like she's kind of very well plugged into this global complex. So I can kind of understand, you know, the demographics or the kind of the psychographic profile of the people who would be typically inclined to donate to her. And to be very honest, I think that they're not going to regret, or, you know, we are not going to see an episode like this not repeat in the future. I think this, there is a definite market for this, you know, relentless demonization and abuse of the prime minister, by extension, since he's seen as a face of the assertive Hindus. So I mean, you will see more players emerging in the space, actually. From an investigation perspective, of course, looks very dubious, you know, in terms of there was no separation between you know, the money that you solicit for activism and charity versus, you know, how you use it for your personal engagement or, you know, bringing in. So obviously, when you are taking money from from the public for a cause, quote unquote, for a cause, you obviously have to maintain very high ethical standards in terms of how the end use of the funds, right? I mean, at least at the minimum, that was really not the case. And funnily enough, you know, once this individual kind of sensed that the government machineries picked up the blunders. In fact, we have to credit a handle in Twitter called Hawkeye, I think, who kind of first flagged these, what are these potential red flags in this entire donation drive, you know, and after that, I think ED is going, just kind of, you know, found all about this. So I don't know how serious is the nature of the offense. I think like further investigations will reveal, but obviously, you know, the standards of basic standard of ethics and integrity in terms of separating donation money from and kind of funneling it to support a certain kind of lifestyle, you know, from days of Tista, this has been a, the problem with this folks is that, you know, activism is a means of livelihood. So in the sense that at some point of time, they kind of just lose that moral compass. So it's largely predictable, I would say. But I wouldn't say that this will be the first one, the last of it. You have many other such charlatans. I mean, to be honest, maybe even across ideological spectrums also, okay. But like, so any kind of, you know, misguided activism, essentially focused on emotionally triggering people, aimed at addressing their prejudice, worst form of prejudice, dehumanizing people, I think it will eventually be problematic. That's my sense, Roshan.
Yeah, and I think the lines are blurring, right? Between journalism and activism, between donating to a charity, donating to a cause, etc. But what do you make of this, allegation that this is actually a way to curtail freedom of speech and freedom of expression and so on?
Yeah, I think that's quite funny because, as I said, you know, IOP is so well networked and plugged into the global Islamist network, the global liberal Islamist nexus, which operates in the Western world largely as a, and you know, basically, I think some part of this apparatus is also connected to the, according to me, the deep state, say in the US or some part of the Europe. See, all these, some of the Western countries, especially in the US, right? Like, there are different dimensions in which the, geopolitical operations happen. Like, one would be like kind of propping up and astroturfing organizations like this, which are invested in, or individuals who are invested in fomenting, fault lines within the society, which is their target. So, I mean, in that sense, she's a very key player. So, I don't know, like, if at all any card that she shouldn't be playing, it's the victimhood card. So it's quite surprising, but
yeah.
Predictable. And also, this some of the characters involved in it. In Indian context, we can talk without facing any accusation that this is some kind of an anti-Semitic dogma or something, because no other part of the world where people have such deep and abiding respect and reverence for, Israel as a state and Jews as a community, right? But I think a lot of these operators are kind of connected to the Open Foundation network of George Soros as well, right? So, he himself is on record a couple of years back saying that he's going to put in a lot of money to, promote, quote unquote, fight against authoritarianism, India's fight to authoritarianism and all that, which is basically a code word for regime change operations. And these kind of people, some of them, are funded through a very complex network of Soros-funded agencies and all that stuff. But I think in her case, I don't think so. Maybe she's part of that network, actually. I think she's more like a individual who's essentially draws a lot of her support from more from the Islamist network, actually. So I think that's my sense. If you really look at it, she doesn't really, if you typically look at the Soros ecosystem, right? They prey on stuff institutional decay, democracy danger and all. But in our case, you can clearly see that it's all about like Muslim victimhood, Islamist victimhood, right? It's not about anything which is like meta issues, I would say. So I think pretty much clear where the donors are for her. So I think of course, she gets all those plugs in international publications and all that, which eventually, all these forces are, in a way, there is tactical convergence that happens all the time, right? But I think she's more on the global Islamist, propaganda network. That's my sense. I could be wrong.
All right, moving on from one controversy to another. Over the last 2 weeks, the hijab controversy in Udupi has been gaining momentum. What started as a group of Muslim students wearing hijab in their classrooms has now ballooned into a law and order situation involving death threats. Karnataka's Udupi College principal, Mr. Rudregowda, has weighed in, reportedly stating that no one has requested for hijab in 35 years. The president of BJP's Udupi Minority Morcha, Mr. Dawood Abubakar, received threats over his comments on the issue. MLA Raghupathi Bhatt, who is also the president of the development committee of the pre-university college, said on Friday that he received threat calls, and most of them were from foreign countries via the internet. Abhishek, what is this controversy? And if you could just probably summarize the contours of it.
I think what happened is through a series of incidents and I would say even accidents, this controversy became snowballed into a big thing. So, and I think several outlets have reported it quite in depth in the last week or two. So, the version I read was on the print. And so what it seems is that there was a protest by ABVP for certain campus-related incident in which even these Muslim girls were participating and their photo came out from that protest, and their parents saw the pictures of them without wearing a hijab. And so from there it started, as in an insistence from the family members that they should be wearing it. Now it seems what has happened all along is these girls would wear the hijab to the college and then take it off before entering the classroom, right? That has been the practice before November, but now they insisted that they should also get the right to wear it within the classrooms, and which was objected by the college authorities. Then they started protesting. There is the CFI, which is the student wing of the PFI/SDPI, right, which is a Muslim political outfit / fundamentalist organization in South India, right? They was apparently supported these protests and helped them garner support and all, while there was obviously a sort of counter protest by certain students who insisted that they should also then have the right to wear saffron scarves and all that. And this thing spread across various colleges in the South Canara region, I guess. And now it has finally reached the courts. I think that's a good thing. Let our courts take a look at these question marks, because I feel there are two or three very fundamental questions at play here, right? The fundamental right of religious liberty, right? Versus the right to equality, right? Which on which the premise of having uniforms in schools, etc., are based on, right? So the question the courts have to look at is which right supersedes the other, right? Is it the individual's right to wear whatever they want, or is it the institution's right to, put a uniform? Then again comes the questions of which institutions have what rights. And this is, again, a slippery slope in India, right? Where we know from our own personal examples or of those of our friends and family that, for example, how say a Catholic institution will prohibit even basic, religious symbols from Hindu students, etc., right? Like a Raksha Bandhan, etc., is also not allowed. So what happens there? Are your fundamental rights only available in public institutions, but not in, let's say minority institutions? So that's a big question for the courts to look at. The other question mark is again on what is the meaning of these garments, like the hijab or the burqa, right? So that is probably more of a question within Muslim society for the Muslims of India to consider, but it raises question marks, right? So for example, if, and I think, various petitioners are making arguments in the line that this is somewhat like an essential religious practice, or this is mandated under their religion. So does that mean that, for example, those Muslim women who do not wear it, are they not, properly following their religion, right? And so I think there was a story yesterday of someone, a topper student in Kashmir, a Muslim student who does not wear this. And she was getting, threats saying that, you should wear it to be a good Muslim and so on. So this is another angle, right, for which Muslim society has to sort of think about, right? What is the meaning of doing this? Of course, it is now being, the discussion is on the people having choice to wear what they want, but it's not as simple as just a choice, right? There is also a deeper meaning behind this kind of religious assertion.
Yeah, I was actually reminded of Harsh and Rajiv's book, actually, Individual Rights in a Civilizational State, right? I mean, that's the topic they address in their book, A New Idea of India. For anyone, I think, who wants to understand some of the deeper points at play here, I think definitely pick up the book. It lends a lot of context to how these things keep happening periodically, sometimes ahead of elections. All right, moving on. In the third controversy for the week, Ashneer Grover, the BharatPay co-founder, and his wife Madhuri Jain have been accused of financial fraud. Ashneer and Madhuri are in the midst of an independent probe that found financial irregularities at the company. The probe found fraudulent transactions, including payments to non-existent vendors, as well as irregularities of invoices being produced to substantiate spends. Grover is temporarily on leave from the company in the aftermath of a leaked audio clip where he allegedly abused an employee of Kotak Mahindra Bank. Nirav, your thoughts?
Yeah, so first is I would like to say that everybody is innocent until proven guilty. So we don't know what the results are. There have been reports. So basically what has happened is the saga snowballed very quickly. So on Jan 6th, there was a leaked audio tape where he is quarreling and like abusing a Kotak Bank employee for not giving him access to credit lines to invest 100 crores, so borrow 100 crores to invest in Nykaa IPO. For whatever reasons that may be, that clip has been deleted. Ashneer claims that it is fake. So we don't really know what has happened. But what this has done is it has brought a lot of negative publicity to the company. Second thing is he's been on Shark Tank, kind of playing the Donald Trump role in like Apprentice or something, being rude and putting down the other entrepreneurs who are coming in. So I think that maybe helps to get eyeballs or whatever, but that was seen in a negative light. And he had been put on leave. After that, what has happened is Sequoia, who are one of the major investors, VC investors, they have asked an independent audit from a risk management consultant, Alvarez and Marshall. And there are some leaked reports which say that there is some wrongdoing. But I think there's a lot of bad corporate governance or like people being asleep at the wheel. So few of the, red flags was, one was for this company, the financial controller and the CFO was Ashneer's wife, who did not have an experience in doing similar job before. It doesn't matter whether she was a fashion designer or was working in fashion designing earlier or her degree. That doesn't matter. But if you have relevant experience, would a $1 billion company or like $2.8 billion company employ somebody completely like this for a CFO role? So that was one red flag. Another red flag was one of the early co-founders, Bhavik Kuladia, was actually arrested for credit card fraud in the US. where he was running a store and he was getting people's personal data. And so I think that is a big red flag. So it seems that, you know, investors have been like trying to jump onto the bandwagon and playing on the India growth story. A lot of them missed out on the big wave of China fintech. So in India, there's been a lot of VCs who are just jumping to get on. To the credit of BharatPay, they've scaled at a blitzkrieg pace, right? They've done blitzscaling very well. They've had ads with like Salman Khan coming on TV, etc. So they've scaled up fast. They are valued at, I think, $2.65 or $2.85 billion. So this is something which needs to be seen. There have been like previous episodes of kind of, you would say, like not the best practices used. Foodpanda shut down in India and Rocket Internet shut its office in 2015. There was a lot of fake orders and fake invoices there as well. But just to keep everything under hush and not to get like negative publicity for the other investments, this was kind of hushed up and people moved on. Here, I think there has been, both sides have appointed lawyers. Ashneer believes that in his mind, the valuation of the company should be $6 billion. And he's made a statement like, if they want him out, they should buy out his shares for rupees 4,000 crores. So I think this is classic, like, you know, first ploy and bargaining. I don't know what happens. But there have been, not just with BharatPay, right? I think if you talk to the startup community, what they're saying is that VCs are coming in with like open checkbooks and taps open, pumping in money, and they're throwing money. And a lot of them don't have the time to go through like a fine tooth comb on all the accounts. And there have been like a lot of money being, you could say, siphoned off or not well spent for the business, right? And I think this is like a wake-up call. So right now he's been accused of fraud, whether it is actually there, done or not, that is besides the point. The main point I want to make is about like corporate governance. And a lot of these startups have been given like a very big free hand. And some of that has been abused. That trust has been abused. It's quite a negative for the whole startup ecosystem, right? So that is one thing. BharatPay had also formed a JV with Centrum and they'd gotten the banking license and they were buying up Punjab Maharashtra Cooperative Bank. So now let us see what happens on that front as well. You had like the ex Standard Chartered Asia Pac CEO, Bindra, who is heading Centrum. So even that remains to be seen. So I think it's a lot of muddy waters out here, but hopefully, even if, in my opinion, like it's an opinion of a skeptic, is a lot of these things will be hushed up. Behind the scenes, there will be a compromise made and some people will be sidelined, some people will be in power, etc. Because they don't want to let this house of cards collapse. I would say there are few very good companies, right? And the Indian startup ecosystem has thrown up a lot of good companies with valid business models, etc. But a lot of them are just, it's a greater fool theory that I'm a fool to invest in this company at this valuation, but my plan is to sell it to a greater fool who will buy it of me at a higher valuation. And it's a game of valuation rather than a game of business models or like customer service or building good products. And, you know, like rising tide lifted all boats. Now that the tide is turning out, we will see who's swimming naked. I'm using Warren Buffet's quote here. And in the external environment as well, with expectations of like tighter monetary policy by the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, etc., what has happened is this excess money or a lot of money which had been printed in the West found its way here. Maybe some of that turns back. And here we will see what all wrong things were being done or like where money was, a lot of time money was being ill spent. Let's put it that way, right? Which is not really necessary for the business, or maybe people are being paid too high salary package, etc., etc. So I think a lot of those things might reverse. So yeah, it's a time to introspect, and maybe once these muddy waters clear, right, that's one of the better times to get in, because a lot of the bad apples get removed and whatever remains are the good ones, right? So it's just the time for that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with everything that you just said, right? I think the sooner we move on from this and you know, take whatever relevant lessons are in terms of corporate governance and so on, the better for us, because I think the Indian startup ecosystem has been in the news for all the positive reasons for a good couple of years at least, right? And I hope that momentum continues, because God knows, I mean, we all remember the 2014, 2015 times of the rocket internet and the housing drama and all of that, right? So yeah. In some geopolitics news, the United States has evacuated its embassy in Ukraine as Russian threat of war looms over the country. Western intelligence officials are warning that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is increasingly imminent. All American staff at the Kiev embassy will be required to leave the country ahead of a feared Russian invasion. The Pentagon announced on Friday it is sending another 3,000 combat troops to Poland to join the 1,700 who are already there in demonstration of American commitment to NATO allies. Abhishek, could you help us understand, you know, what really is happening here?
Yeah, so, I mean, the Russian troop buildup, etc., kind of continues to be there, right, at the Ukraine border. And so now, this past week, the US took the decision to pull out most of their folks from their Kiev embassy. So, yeah, I think tensions remain. A few developments in the last week include the meeting of the French president, right, Macron, who visited Russia and met Putin. And also, I think the last night there was a call between Biden and Putin, right? So I think diplomatic efforts are continuing, but Russia is sort of refusing to de-escalate as of now. So yeah, I think most countries in Europe right now are probably not in a position to militarily tackle Russia, right? So that is the reason why obviously there's a lot of tension, and the US is obviously split in terms of, you know, they would rather not have to focus on Europe, right? And they would rather prefer to focus on China and the Indo-Pacific. And this is sort of a distraction for their larger strategic goals. But at the same time, allowing sort of Russia to walk into Ukraine would sort of send tremors down the West in a larger way, right? So, yeah, the situation remains quite tense, I suppose.
Do check out the couple of episodes we've done on the Velina's Talk series, where, you know, we have covered some of this, geopolitical issues.
Yeah, I think the one, you know, with Elbridge Colby, I would definitely
recommend this,
right? And he's one of those few rare US experts who actually explicitly acknowledges the role India is playing, right, in containing China, right, and gives credit to India for that. So yeah, I think it's well worth the listen.
And India has relaxed travel norms for 82 countries, doing away with home quarantine upon return. The new norms will come into effect from Monday and will also remove the need for travelers to undertake an RT-PCR test on the 8th day of their return. The countries added to this list include US, New Zealand, Switzerland, Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, Saudi Arabia, and the Netherlands. Instead of 7-day home quarantine as mandated earlier, all travelers will self-monitor their health for 14 days after their arrival. Well, I do hope that travel comes back and then we can move around freely. Moving on, in some important news, the Quad foreign ministers meet proceeded successfully, with members resolving to work towards a free and open Indo-Pacific. At a joint media briefing after the talks, Australia's Marise Payne said the Quad foreign ministers reaffirmed their support to principles of openness and protection of national sovereignty. The Australian Prime Minister also said that he was reassured by the incredible support that Australia had received from its Quad partners. It was the third in-person meeting of Quad foreign ministers following their meeting in Tokyo in October 2020 and the inaugural meeting in New York in September 2019. Nirav, Abhishek, what do you guys make of this?
Yeah, so I think as you mentioned, like the earlier part, right? So there is two sets of like crises in two areas. Geopolitical crises are going on. So like the Russia Ukraine is one of it. The other one is like China and Taiwan, and kind of the Quad is like a group of democracies. This is like a incremental progress each time, right? So I think they are going ahead. There is a little more coordination on like intelligence, defense related things. So I think it is all going in increments towards strengthening like democracies across the world. But beyond that, I don't think there's going to be any sort of like military boots on the ground, or I don't think there's very, whether or not, I don't know whether it's posturing by Russia and Ukraine, or so that Ukraine doesn't join NATO, etc. But I don't think like the Quad, like India or Australia are going to go, or Japan for that matter, are going to put boots on the ground some in some of those places. But yeah, it remains to be seen. I don't know, maybe Abhishek can add more.
Yeah, well, I mean, we will cover some of these things in following episodes of the Wellina's talk, right?
Yeah, I think Nirav said it right. Like, there was nothing spectacular or big that came out of this meeting. It was more incremental discussions and progress, right? Whether it is on vaccines or in general, you know, the security situation in the Indo-Pacific.
All right, and finally, the first day of the IPL auctions occurred yesterday. Ishan Kishan became the most expensive buy as he went to Mumbai Indians for 15.25 crore. Deepak Chahar was sold to Chennai Super Kings for 14 crores. Shreyas Iyer was clinched by Kolkata Knight Riders for 12.25 crores. Avesh Khan was bought by Lucknow Super Giants for about 10 crores. The highest in the history of IPL for uncapped players. Abhishek, I know you followed this closely yesterday. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, actually, more than the auction, sort of something quite unfortunate happened while I was watching live, right? So at around 1 or 1:30 p.m., the person conducting the auction, he sort of fainted and fell down, right, in front of a live audience. That was quite a scary thing, right? And amazingly, they managed to put the show back on in 2 hours, where they called up Charu Sharma, who was probably just, you know, chilling at his home, to sort of go from just watching the TV to suddenly conduct an auction without any prior experience. I think he did a great job. You know, you have to sort of give credit. I mean, luckily he lives in Bangalore, so they were able to call him up. I'm sure there might have been one or two others who might have been called up, but it was quite incredible to see him just walk into the venue and start conducting auctions suddenly. I guess there were jokes of how, you know, Bangalore traffic probably was causing a little bit of delay as well. But, you know, that goes with the territory. But yeah, I think other than that, the big names you called out, right? Some very young Indian players made incredible amounts of money, right, yesterday. So good for them. I think that will sort of put a lot of pressure and expectation on these kind of players. So when you are like one of the top rated franchise players, the expectation now is that, you know, you'll not only do well for your franchise, but also hopefully start performing well for Indian team as well, right? Because now you're a big name player. So yeah, I think looking forward to how the folks like Ishan Kishan or Deepak Chahar become mainstays in the Indian team.
Yeah,
I think the consensus was that, you know, Delhi did a very good job in sort of making sure that, so suppose they would understand that team A or B wanted a certain player, they would keep bidding to sort of jack up the prices and ensure that the purse of the other team would go down significantly, and then they would quietly back away, knowing that now this is becoming dangerous for them also. So I think Delhi played the auction game pretty well yesterday.
Yeah, it was the CEO of GMR, right? I mean,
yeah.
No, definitely interesting. And I'm really excited by the pipeline that it builds for the India team, you know, I mean, really kudos to the IPL on that front. I mean, remarkable. If you would have thought of it like 20 years back that this would happen, I mean, it would be really unreal. So, all right. I think we are at the end of another weekly. Thank you again, Nirav, Abhishek and Prasanna kind of dropped off because of internet connection. Thank you again for lending your perspectives on the news and events of the week. Thanks guys for tuning in. Do check us out again next week. We have a bunch of episodes lined up and let us know what you think of it on social media, etc. We're at Bharat Vartha. Thank you and have a great week ahead. Bye-bye.